If I may say just a couple of things before we start. My daughter, who is four, said to remind you that this is the same war, but more of the war. So if you were here last week, this is the same introduction, but less of the introduction. First, I'd like to explain very briefly, if you weren't here, what was the basis of this, so you have some idea of what is included and what is left out. Nearly all of the material you will see came from what came to be known as the DOD Kinneys. On the 20th of August, 1965, the Department of Defense began regularly videotaping the network evening news programs as broadcast in Washington, taking the parts out about the Vietnam War, particularly those involving the Defense Department, and splicing them together on reels, either one or two and occasionally three reels, depending how much material there was. This material was not originally preserved with any sort of archival thought in mind, but rather simply to make information available to military people who hadn't seen the television coverage of the war. Because of the process I just described, if you are a film person, you realize that this print that you will see, the videotape that you will see from the print, is four, five, or six generations removed from the original, which itself was often color negative film sent via satellite. Therefore, the quality is not particularly good. Nonetheless, it is the best overall record that exists. I have, as I tried to explain last week in response to a couple of questions, concentrated on the reporting of the war itself because this is the best record of that. If you want a record of protest, of reaction in this country, of public opinion, and so forth, you need to turn to other sources. I need to again thank a lot of people who helped me, particularly colleagues at the University of Wisconsin and Madison, the members of the staff here of the National Archives, of the Wilson Center for International Scholars across the mall, particularly Jim Billington, Peter Braestrup, here Jim Moore, Bill Murphy, Les Waffen, and a whole bunch more. Also, some material you will see from time to time I obtained by other sources because it was not available in the Kinneys, and I will try to explain that if necessary. A bit of short information on the procedure. We will look at the videotape, if you will, for about 35 or 40 minutes, after which a short explanation, another bit of videotape, another short explanation, and after that, a general discussion. The discussion will include Don Oberdorfer of the Washington Post, who's written a book I'm sure most of you are familiar with called Tet, Peter Braestrup of the Wilson Quarterly, formerly the Washington Post, the New York Times, who's written a book called Big Story, Ron Nessen, who's currently unemployed but formerly worked at NBC News, Ron Steinman, who is at NBC News and who was bureau chief for NBC at this, the time of the film you were seeing, and Wilson Hall, who is an NBC correspondent who was also in Saigon at this time. There are a number of people from here last week, again, who were also distinguished, who were there. I will not try to mention all of them. In any case, I did get a lot of phone calls from fans and detractors who said that they would like more explanation as we went along. If I may, I would just like to explain for 15 seconds that what I've tried to do is to have literary criticism here based primarily from people who have read the book. Therefore, we're going to see the book first and look at the videotapes. I'm sorry that there is not more time to explain every bit as we go along, but I think that if you'll stick with us through the videotape, you'll have a better understanding of the questions, arguments, and so forth that come out of it, with the exception of the short breaks I talked about. Thank you. If I may very briefly, just to give you a bit of perspective, what we have done so far is spent a good deal of time on the NBC retrospective of the Dak To battle. Some people would argue that the so-called Tet Offensive began with the winter-spring offensive of 1967-68, beginning in Dak To and two other locations. And the middle part was the so-called Tet Offensive beginning the 30th, 31st of January 1968, and continued with a third part about which historians disagree and are not clear. Then some various bits and pieces through January. The last emphasis, as you saw, on Khe Sanh was on the 26th, the 20th, and 29th of January. For a brief bit of background, Don Oberdorfer, who was author of the book Tet, is presently a staff correspondent writer for the Washington Post covering the State Department.
The most important battle lines in the summer and fall and winter of 1967 and first month of 1968 were not in Vietnam, but just exactly where you sat tonight in the living rooms of the American people in front of a television set. There were about 500,000 troops, United States troops, in Vietnam after over 2 years in a combat role. The American public and leadership was increasingly dissatisfied and confused, partly because of a steady diet of reports from the war zone of battles which seemed not to settle anything much. A pollster in the summer of 1967, asking people, found that half of Americans said they had no clear idea what the war was about. Most people could not remember how it started, how the United States got into it. We seemed to go to war by inches, someone said. Until then, until the time you've seen, for all the talk of Vietnam on television, most people had been asked to do very little about it and had done very little about it. Of the young men between 18 and 26, only about 1 in 50 had been drafted, and of those, 1 in 2 had gone to Vietnam. For most people, the war was quite remote, except for the impact that they gained from watching the reports from the war zone. They were spectators until August 3rd, 1967, which to me is probably one of the crucial unsung dates in the Vietnam War. On that day, President Johnson called for a 10% surtax on personal and corporate income to pay for the Vietnam War. And then it became very personal for a lot of people for whom it had been quite impersonal before. The political polls, which had been showing a steady decline in support for the war as it continued over many months, showed even more of a drop. For the first time, more people said to Gallup's interviewers that it was a mistake to go to war in Vietnam than said the opposite. People in Capitol Hill began to switch their positions from support for the war to opposition for the war. But it was difficult to switch because many had become strongly committed in public as the early innings of the war proceeded, and now they were groping for some way to change their mind without quite seeming to do so. Time magazine switched its position on the war, as did a number of newspapers. At this point, the Johnson administration saw that it was facing a serious problem in the swiftly declining support of Americans at large, and especially the political leadership and private leadership of America. And President Johnson and his administration launched what has come to be known as the Success Offensive to convince Americans that we are winning, and that the reports that you have seen and others in print and otherwise coming back from the war zone were in their overall dimension incorrect, that the war was being won, it was being won handily, and we were in sight of the end. The big gun of this offensive was General William C. Westmoreland, who was called home by President Johnson late in 1967 during the time of the press conference, which you saw earlier, went to Capitol Hill, talked to congressmen, made a speech to the American people, and said, "We are now at the point where the end begins to come into view. In 2 years or less, we can turn the job over increasingly to the South Vietnamese and prepare to go home." This was the word that Americans had been waiting for, the light at the end of the tunnel, and it was in this setting which obtained with the press saying we're not winning, the government saying we are winning, that the events of the 30th and 31st of January 1968, the Tet battle, began.
I'd like to start by introducing Peter Braestrup. We always move things on the stage while Peter is talking. Peter Braestrup is author of the book called Big Story, which is an analysis of the press performance during Tet. He is editor of the Wilson Quarterly, formerly bureau chief in Saigon of the Washington Post, and a New York Times correspondent in Vietnam as well. Peter, then I will introduce the rest.
Well, I'd just like to actually... Don Oberdorfer wrote the book, but I'll just briefly, that book, his book, Tet book, recap more or less what the scholars have discovered about the Tet offensive, very rudimentary fashion, and what they have discovered and what we knew at the time, or at least the first few days, are two quite different things. First of all, within a week of the first attacks, the melodrama ended in most of the cities except at Wei, and the melodrama continued at Khe Sanh. Khe Sanh became the number one melodrama for TV, particularly for CBS, and the number one, statistically, the number one subject for page one pictures in my newspaper, Post, because it was the only melodrama left after the first week of the Tet Offensive. So you will see statistically about 25%. You saw the beginning of the siege and the continued interest in that siege. Almost everybody had the same scenario when they went in and said about the same things. Something awful may happen, and that's the way we felt. What we did not tend to report was that Khe Sanh was only 12 miles and within long-range artillery range of friendly forces, that the B-52s, which we did not see, were conducting an unprecedented campaign. Bombing tonnage equal, finally, to five Hiroshimas on the hills around us. We were very subjective about Khe Sanh flying in and out, and I think you see that very clearly. We didn't know much about the overall situation at Khe Sanh, and in that sense, that was a microcosm of the whole coverage of the Tet Offensive. And to recapitulate, after the first week of the offensive, except at Wei, which then became, after the first week or 10 days, there was still fighting in the suburbs of Saigon, but it had died down considerably. You could leave the airport and so on without any difficulty. After the first week of the Tet Offensive, the Tet Offensive, we now know, was more or less called off by the North Vietnamese, as Don Oberdorfer has reported. They knew much sooner than we did that they had failed to bring on their maximum objectives, that is, cause the South Vietnamese government and army to disintegrate under the pressure of these widespread attacks, and the casualties were very heavy, and so on. That's easier to say now, although officialdom said it then. It's easier for historians to figure that out now than it was for newsmen to figure it out. Essentially, what you also saw was a good deal of what Don Oberdorfer correctly describes as a success offensive prior to Tet. The administration is trying to boost its ratings in the polls, secure public support for the war, a war for which there was no easily explainable strategy except to persevere. It was a kind of endless operation. And newsmen kept reacting to that, as you could see before Tet. The North Vietnamese were generally pictured as 10 feet tall, or certainly undismayed by the American forces, and the American forces were pictured at Dak To and elsewhere as kind of fumbling around in the dark and kind of didn't have their thing together and so on, which was not quite true tactically. It was certainly true in the White House. The Tet Offensive, after 3 weeks, the city of Hue was recaptured. This had been a focus. None of us knew much about Hue. We called it the ancient imperial capital, and we had kind of a vicarious nostalgia for good old Hue. A lot of us had only got there during the siege, but we kind of wept for it on camera and in print. There was a lot of kind of subjectivism going on during Tet because although we claimed we didn't believe what officialdom told us prior to Tet, we never expected to get scared that badly. And we were scared. I speak mostly for myself. The heroic figure seated at your right undoubtedly confronted the whole thing without a tremor, but I was scared. And that was reflected, as you could see, in a lot of this reportage and also in the print reportage. The notion of Vietnam in flames, shock, surprise, our own psychological reactions being projected upon the Vietnamese. We had no idea how the Vietnamese felt about this attack. We had relatively no direct contact with the Vietnamese. We were tourists, aliens in this country. We didn't know whether they loved us or hated us, or loved or hated the Viet Cong, or whatever. During Tet, we projected a lot of our reactions onto theirs. It was a hell of a story. I think it supplied, I think Ron Unsteinman said later, the NBC bureau chief, sitting over here to the right, he said you could just walk, for the first time in the war, you could walk out your, leave the hotel and with the camera crew and go three blocks and you'd find a story, people killing each other. And so a lot of our early stories were concentrated in the Saigon area. And I think it's fair to say in terms of still photographs and television, they had more than they could use. You know, the best kind of film. They didn't have to go out on they didn't have to waste their time going out on a helicopter looking for a fight, because there it was right in their backyards. All they had to do was go down to it. That's why you remember the fight over the hotel, variously called an apartment and a hotel. That was so convenient. People would go over in the morning, you shoot your film, and you'd have it on the scat back that afternoon. It was a very convenient situation for, and hazardous too, but it was convenient, and there was a story you could count on. And that's why after the fighting died at Saigon, the focus shifted to Hue. That was a story you could count on every day. You didn't waste manpower. And after Hue, you went to Khe Sanh. Granted, not much was happening at Khe Sanh, but it was terrific pictures. You know, there were wounded, shells going off, and there were always those same four wrecked aircraft. We lost four wrecked aircraft at Khe Sanh, and they must have been on the screen 55 times. The cover of Newsweek, the front page of the Washington Post. It's drama. We covered Tet the way we cover a natural disaster. There's no hope in sight. The worst is yet to come. Now, did this have any, and in retrospect, historically, this was all wet. In terms of the tactical situation in Vietnam, Don Oberdorfer has written, other scholars have written, Francis Fitzgerald wrote Fire in the Lake, which essentially is a very anti-American book, brilliantly written. They all agree on one thing. What I would consider to be the net impression conveyed on film over this 2 month period was historically wide of the mark. Tet was a military and political setback for Hanoi, a temporary setback as it turned out, for Hanoi in South Vietnam. The disaster occurred back here, politically and psychologically. And it didn't occur throughout the country. I will argue with Oberdorfer a little bit about who exactly got turned around on the war. At Tet, the public opinion polls do not show a sudden drop in support for the war. And so the same kind of gradual decline that had been taking place before. It showed a real drop for Lyndon Baines Johnson. But what my theory is, can only be that, is that this kind of disaster image that was conveyed, I think everybody who watched it can agree that it was kind of a disaster image. It was not certainly the portrait of victory. And it could not be expected to be a portrait of victory. We didn't know any better at the time, and we took what was there, and it looked bad. Our sins were those of omission and of commission, in part by projecting more bad news. The worst is yet to come. We didn't know whether the worst was yet to come or not. Our sins of omission were these. After the recapture of Wei, 3 weeks after, in my view, 3 weeks after the attacks began, neither the networks, who can be somewhat forgiven given their particular needs and demands for melodrama, but more importantly, the New York Times and Washington Post, of which I was the local commander-in-chief, and the wire services, AP and UPI, and Newsweek, did not fan out and kind of check up our first impressions. We did not correct our first impressions. So in effect, we let this early disaster image, which was almost inevitable, given the way we look at the world, we let that persist. We did not exercise the professional self-discipline and so on to go back at least three weeks after the attacks and say, things aren't quite as bad as they seemed at first. This fact has been noted by several people from the networks who covered the exercise at the time. Instead of going back and correcting the first impressions, giving a more stable, kind of balanced picture of recovery, Saigon government began to muddle through, all was not lost, that much we could say. We didn't do that. Time magazine, which was no longer an enthusiastic endorser of the war, did do that. They showed it could be done. They didn't do it very well, but they did it. They did it. They tried it. They went to each area, sent out their reporters who were very good, and they kind of put together a two-page condensed assessment of what things looked like then, and in effect said the title of the piece was Repairing the Damage. And essentially, that's what was going on, militarily, politically, and so on. The bulk of us didn't do that. Instead, by and large, our bosses at home were so caught up by the melodrama and by the repercussions of what they saw. There was a new melodrama starting at home. And I think Lyndon Johnson had a lot to do with his own crisis back home. I've made that argument in extenso. I won't bore you with it all. The bottom line is, I do not think that the press coverage, the television coverage, which was distorted, not through ideological conviction, but through the way we do things and how we overreact when we're taken by surprise and the president is kind of groggy and there's no kind of framework, and we've had a propaganda campaign before, and we were kind of all at sea, this kind of boiled up. That did not turn the American people against the war. There's no evidence that the press coverage, as both particularly television's champions and critics seem to agree that, and I think they agree on a false assumption, that television brought the reality of the war into the living room and the people couldn't stand it. The Korean War had censorship and no television, and the anti-war sentiment showed the same curve in the polls roughly as the Vietnam War, which had television and no censorship. You can't blame television for losing the Vietnam War, or credit it for getting us out of it, in my view. I wandered a little far afield. I threw out some things here that people can throw stones at. The Vietnam War, the Tet Offensive was a temporary setback for Hanoi in South Vietnam. It was in some way, and I don't think we know quite how, it was a disaster for Lyndon Johnson and his administration in Washington, D.C.
If I may, again, you've met Don Oberdorfer before, but on your left, coming across this way, Wilson Hall, who's an NBC correspondent here in Washington and has variously been, besides here, in Cairo and Cuba and Saigon and a bunch of other places. Ron Steinman, who's presently the Today Show producer in Washington, has variously been bureau chief in Saigon, head of news for all of NBC in stationed in Asia and Hong Kong, executive and a producer in London, New York, and a bunch of other places. And Ron Nessen, who, if you were here last week, you saw in Vietnam early in 1960, in the coverage of the war in 1965 and 66, was back for a second tour during the time you just saw, and has been an NBC correspondent most of the time in Washington, D.C., and was, as you very well know, press secretary. Would you, gentlemen, like a bit of, if we were doing television, what would be called the Fairness Doctrine? Okay, we'll open it up for questions, and if you will, give us just 4 seconds between each person here, because there are a bunch of people downstairs who can't see them till they walk up here and can be seen on camera. Go.
Governments need pejoratives to sell wars, and societies need pejoratives to accept the slaughter. And we have a long history in this society, as others have, using words like con, crowd, nip, and so on. And Vietnam was not short of pejoratives. In the bars in Pittsburgh, where I was hanging out at the time, gook and slant were the words usually used. The media were a little gentler and more often used enemy, red, and Viet Cong. So the questions I have are these. First of all, have any of you gentlemen ever stopped to examine the history of the word Viet Cong? What are its origins? Is it truly a word indigenous to Vietnam? Secondly, did you ever stop to recognize the role you had in selling the war and using these pejoratives? And thirdly, why didn't you use gook and slant as well as the others?
Ron.
First of all, the word Viet Cong is indigenous to Vietnam. It means, if I'm wrong, somebody can correct me, Vietnamese communist. My wife, who's Vietnamese. C-O-N-G, yes. Right. But, well, no, that's not, I don't think that's the point. I think you're looking for something that doesn't exist. Our role in Vietnam was not to sell the war. I had, I don't know how many thousands of stories go through me, across my desk, and stories that I assigned. And never once was the intent to create an impression that A, war is good, B, the enemy is bad, C, that we are right. In none of the reports that the people who worked for me filed was the word we ever used. In other words, I would hope that most of what our people did was objective reporting, and I can speak, I think, for the other networks too in that sense. I think what you're reflecting is an attitude that I would hear on occasion when I returned to the United States from Vietnam for a visit, that our role over there was to do the opposite. Now, war is hell. There is no question about that. People get killed, people die, people get wounded, people are displaced. It is probably the ugliest experience that man enters into. But that doesn't mean that reporting, which doesn't purport to be objective, shouldn't be at least a little fair and show that. Now, I disagree with Peter on the idea that the war, that showing the things we showed on television didn't turn some people around? Well, fine, we don't know, but I disagree. I think the point is that perhaps it would have taken a little longer to turn the people around, that perhaps after the experience of Korea, where we do know that people were being turned around by just the sense of all that death over there, it would have come faster if Korea had more television. The words slope, slant, gook were pejoratives, are pejoratives. But they don't belong anywhere in the kind of reporting that I think we turned out. Yes. Well, I did a lot of praying. A lot of the people who worked for me were friends of mine. I tried not to get too close to them. They were, you used the word human resources. We worked, I don't know how the other bureaus really worked, but I generally made most of the decisions where to send people because most of the people were out all the time and would come in to me and say, I don't want to go anywhere, but if I have to go somewhere, where should I go? I had at my command at least more information than they did, particularly in that they were out all the time. All the time is not exactly fair. They spent a certain amount of time out in the field and a certain amount of time in Saigon. It was based on intelligence that I had, not up here perhaps, but intelligence that was coming into me on a daily basis, both from the American military, the Vietnamese military, Vietnamese reporters we had, and some of the best Vietnamese reporters we had were those who carried cameras for us, ran sound, were our drivers and such. And a lot of times it was guesswork. A lot of times it was where you could get a helicopter to get you to someplace until the war in the streets started, and then you could literally get into an automobile, drive three blocks, and find whatever you had to. It's thinking back 10, 12 years. I started there in 66, and I left in 68. A lot of times, you took a bunch of pins in your hand, put a map on the floor, and threw them up, and hoped that they came down in the right place. One of the interesting competitive things that we had is that if all three networks went out together, all three networks didn't go with the same platoon. So there were three network crews with three separate platoons in a single action. And God help us if one of the other networks got a good story and we did not, because then we'd get our own sort of rockets telling us, asking us why we didn't get the kind of coverage that, say, CBS did or ABC. That didn't happen too often. There was a sense, and I think this is interesting too, I think there was a sense of competition both in Vietnam and back in New York that was much different. The competition in Vietnam was really to get the best story. The competition more often than not in New York was who gets it faster. So if you were covering an action and your reporter in the field told you that said action, for him at least, hadn't developed, he wanted an extra day, and if he did, he was crazy, but he wanted to stay out there a little longer, you let him stay a little longer, and maybe your story came in the second day and was on the air the second day, but it was better. That's a choice we had to make on the ground, and it's something that we often fought New York on, because the producers in New York wanted something immediate.
Right back there, sure.
Is there any theory, or has anyone held the theory that North Vietnamese dependent on Tet Offensive as psychological warfare to the point of being affected, as the first general said, melodrama, making people think that
We really, to this day, don't know precisely why the North Vietnamese put on the Tet Offensive, and I guess really the only story that remains to be told of it is the real North Vietnamese story of why they did what they did and what they expected and what they perceived as it went along. We do know from what was revealed pretty well at the time that the planning for this began around August of the year before, in other words, around 5 months previous, and was very methodical and well planned out, and seems to have, at least in its maximum objective, aimed for the theoretical uprising, the general offensive and general uprising, which in North Vietnamese or Vietnamese communist theory had been the way in which the war, this war and other wars, were to be won. There is not much evidence, really, that they understood before what kind of effect this would have in the United States. There's very little in any of the documentation or any of the defectors or captured prisoners and so on to indicate that the North Vietnamese calculated what was the effect was going to be. I hope I've answered your question as best I can. It really can't be answered until someday. Perhaps they will publish something of the same quality as they published on the final offensive in 1975, which gave us a really very good idea of what they had in mind, what they did when, and how they changed their plans to suit the situation on the ground.
If I may add just one note, we'll take up next week, if for those of you who are interested, it's Tuesday night next week, not Wednesday night, Tuesday night. We'll take up with the, immediately after Lyndon Johnson had given the television speech in which he said he would not seek re-election, and the peace talks began, and go on from there, sir.
I would like to ask Mr. Bracewell.
Let me repeat the question for those who might not have heard downstairs. The question was to Peter and whoever else, how much training did the American correspondents have in such matters as military tactics and knowledge of strategy and so forth? Peter?
Well, the
damn little, per se. You have to remember that newspapers and even television networks, with their resources, do not generally do much kind of in-service training for specific assignments, the big exceptions being language training for the Soviet Union and so on, a few language posts. But I think everybody will agree with me that nobody was sent, for example, as they could have been, to the pacification, the State Department's Vietnam School over here. I investigated that, I remember, for the Washington Post, and urged, as did other Vietnam veterans of the Post, that our people, before they go out there, at least go through and get the geography and so on. Essentially, newsmen pick it up on the spot. We read a few books and so on, but I think if I got real nitpicky, either with my own stories. And I considered myself an old salt. I'd been in the Marine Corps in Korea and the Algerian War, and I thought I was very knowledgeable. And yet I think I was as mistaken about Khe Sanh and as unsophisticated, really. I think it's a lack of sophistication that shows all through that, most of that TV reportage, a preoccupation with the vignette, with the human, a preoccupation shared by a lot of print people, including me. There were very few people who could kind of look at things, military things in context, kind of balance things out. Was this really as terrible as it looked? You talk to a private first class who's just been wounded or has just come out of action, he's in one frame of mind. You talk to him 3 hours later after he's had hot chow and he's still alive, he's in another frame of mind. I've been through it myself. We weren't very sophisticated about military, tactical military situations, particularly at Tet, where we were encountering for the first time battles that lasted for more than a week, where we were encountering for the first time street fighting, where we were kind of encountering for the first time the prolonged encirclement of an American unit. And we were tired and exhausted and not too sophisticated and shocked, and really we were quite overwhelmed by this in its larger sense. And I think that's why we didn't ask a lot of the questions after the first 3 weeks. We didn't go spooking around the way we should have. Some people got pieces of it, but it was an unsophisticated performance. It was new to us. We learn on the job. In 1972, when Hanoi attacked again, we were a lot more sophisticated. I think we did a job that was 100% better. And equally dangerous assignments and so on, but we were sophisticated by then. We learned.
Wilson Hall.
Well, on that, we certainly didn't go to school, but I was a junior officer in World War II, a junior officer in Korea, covered the Korean War for NBC, covered coups, counter-coups, and under-the-counter-coups in Latin America, covered one of several Middle Eastern wars before I was sent over to Vietnam. So I think there were many of us over there, although we were certainly not brilliant tacticians or strategicians. We certainly had been in wars before and knew enough, as some of our younger colleagues did not, that any time there was a firefight, this meant that the battle was either going to be won or going to be lost. And unlike some of my younger colleagues in the television, did not call all men sir, even if they were privates or PFCs and so forth on camera. So I do think that many of us did have, as Peter pointed out, many of us, although we certainly weren't generals or colonels, we certainly had covered or been in other wars and generally knew where to look. This did not keep us from making the mistakes which Peter pointed out. I do like to disassociate myself from the fact that I didn't do anything, Peter, after 3 or 4 months after the Tet Offensive because of my heroism, which simply meant that I survived the Tet Offensive. I was sent to cover the Nigerian Civil War. And so I had nothing to do with that one. I do think many of us knew a lot more about general military tactics, although I'm not for a single second disagreeing with Peter when he says we didn't get the big picture when you're getting shot at. It's very difficult to get the big picture sometimes.
I could add just one short note, and then Ron Simon, and that is that the vast majority of all the television correspondents who worked in Vietnam, according to a survey that I did of about 125, had in fact had military training. Whether or not that you'd consider that, I don't know. And several had done several tours in Vietnam as officers. Phil Brady and Frank Mariano come to mind immediately. Ron.
There's just one word that Peter used that bothered me a little bit, and that was the word sophisticated. I found in my experience there, and it was better than 2.5 years, that the military lacks sophistication. The military lacked foresight. The military lacked understanding.